This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden won six states in the early results from Tuesday's Democratic presidential nominating contest that spanned 14 states from coast to coast.
We need to bring everybody along. Everybody. We want a nominee who will beat Donald Trump. But also keep Nancy Pelosi the Speaker of the House. Win back the United States Senate. If that's what you want, join us.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won two states, with the results still out in California.
Tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination. And we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of this country.
Senator Elizabeth Warren trails both Sanders and Biden in the race for delegates, and with the early results in from Tuesday night, former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg's path to the White House may have disappeared, with a weak showing in the 14 states that held primaries. People in the southern U.S. state of Tennessee are still in shock after tornadoes tore through the state in the middle of the night Tuesday, killing at least 25 people and causing extensive damage. Tennessee's Governor Bill Lee says people around the state are rallying to help those in need, especially in the capital city of Nashville and the surrounding counties. President Donald Trump said he plans to visit the affected areas across Tennessee on Friday. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com, or also on the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Observers say there is still a gap between President Trump's comments on the coronavirus and the public comments from the members of the White House task force that's headed by Vice President Mike Pence. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Coronavirus. We're really working hard on it.
President Trump's public comments seem a bit rosier than those of the experts. Federal health officials are issuing solemn warnings about the coronavirus. Yes, it will spread. No, there isn't adequate testing just yet, although they're making progress on distributing test kits. And no, there is no vaccine, and there won't be one for probably about a year, says Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was showing President Trump the lab at the National Institutes of Health, comparing this to the SARS outbreak.
Phase one trial. Remember, that doesn't mean you have a vaccine. Right. It means for safety. It was 20 months. Then H5N1 influenza, we got it down to 11.
Republican Senator Lamar Alexander has advice for the president. Let the non-political public health officials do the talking. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The virus has created a shortage in hand sanitizers. On many drugstore and supermarket shelves, there are scarce supplies of sanitizers in many areas here in the U.S. As the AP's Ed Donahue reports, finding the alcohol-based sanitizers is becoming almost impossible.
Market research shows a big jump in the sale of hand sanitizers, wipes, and liquid soap. With all their use, buses and subway trains are breeding grounds for germs. In New York, MTA boss Patrick Foy says cleaning crews are ready.
Trains, cars, and buses will be cleaned daily, with the MTA's full fleet being disinfected every 72 hours.
Turnstiles, elevators, and escalators will be cleaned daily.
This is a substantial investment of time and resources, and a substantial increase in both the frequency and intensity of disinfecting.
The CDC recommendation is washing hands with warm or cold water and then lathering soap for 20 seconds. As far as coughing and sneezing, block with the elbow, not your hands. I'm Ed Donahue.
The U.S. Federal Reserve cut its benchmark interest rate by a half percentage point in a surprise move aimed at addressing what it described as the evolving economic risk posed by the coronavirus. The AP's Julie Walker reports.
The Dow sank 785 points to close at 25,917. It had surged 5% a day earlier on hopes for aid from the Fed and other central banks. In another sign of the market's caution, the yield on the 10-year Treasury sank below 1% for the first time in history. While the cut gave some investors exactly what they'd been asking for, the Fed says the ultimate solution will have to come from health experts, not central banks.
That's Julie Walker from the AP reporting. And for more news, please join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed the re-election of President Faure Gnassingbé.
We are very satisfied with the decision by the Constitutional Court confirming that Mr. Faure Gnassingbé continues to be our president, and we want to take the opportunity to express our sincere thanks to the Togolese population.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. A Liberian war crimes court campaigner says he was beaten and tortured on Tuesday by President Weah's security. Sudan's transitional government lifts restrictions on aid agencies. Meanwhile, the transitional government has been given reasons for firing over 100 diplomats earlier this week. And the UN cancels hundreds of human rights events over coronavirus concerns.
The Director General specified that that would entail cancelling all side events and encouraging representatives to refrain from travelling to Geneva for the rest of the session.
Kenya also cancels a parliamentary delegation to New York because of coronavirus concerns. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed Tuesday the re-election of President Faure Gnassingbé. The court confirmed the election commission results, which gave President Gnassingbé 70% of the total votes and 19% for main opposition candidate Abayomi Kojo. The opposition had rejected the results, saying they were made up. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says now President Gnassingbé can focus on the work of developing the country.
We are very satisfied that now the election period is over with the decision by the Constitutional Court confirming that Mr. Faure Gnassingbé continues to be our president. So we are very happy, and we want to take the opportunity to express our sincere thanks to the Togolese population.
But the opposition still say that the results were fabricated. Did the court take their concerns into consideration?
You know, we had more than 9,389 voting bureaus. And the concern by Mr. Agbayome was related to not more than 10 voting bureaus. So you can see this is completely meaningless. And we hope he will stick to the decision by the Constitutional Court, and now we have to move with normal work developing Togo.
So, Gilbert, the U.S. Embassy in Lomé had asked for the Elections Commission to make public the results of each polling booth. Did that happen?
No. U.S. Embassy is not the president of Togo. I don't see Togolese population, the Togolese government, or the Togolese president, or the ambassador of Togo in the States asking the U.S. government to do things that have not been provided for by the rules of the laws. And maybe the embassy did not take time to read the Togolese electoral law. So this is not something serious that we can consider.
Gilbert, did your government put the Catholic Archbishop in Togo and opposition candidate Mr. Kojo, did you put them under house arrest?
No, not at all. I think the bishop you are referring to is completely free. Before the election, there was a number of religious leaders, including bishops, who take part in the political process. They expressed their support, and they were even with Mr. Agbayome Kojo. So if Togolese express themselves against the will and the hope of some bishops, so this is democracy. So there's no need to put anyone under house arrest or to arrest anyone.
When do you expect President Faure Gnassingbé will form a new government? And should people expect that he will form an inclusive government?
Anyway, I don't have the power to express his behalf. I don't know whether he would like to form an all-inclusive government or not. But the only thing I can tell you is that his current mandate is valid until early May 2020. So between now and end of April for him to swear in and then to form, if he so wish, a new government. So now we will return to work. We need to make sure that the huge expectation by the Togolese population, their aspirations for development, for well-being, are met. So this is the most important for us now.
Gilbert, thank you very much. It's always nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lome. Kenyan members of parliament who were set to attend a meeting in New York City have been asked to return their allowances after their trip was cancelled due to coronavirus fears. Meanwhile, the National Assembly Health Committee has asked the Cabinet Secretaries for Health, Transport and Interior to appear before the committee for questioning about the Chinese airline that was cleared to land in Kenya despite the cancellation of airlines in and out of China. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Some of the Kenyan women leaders were scheduled to travel this coming weekend for the 64th session of the Commission on the Status of Women in New York City, United States of America. And while making announcements in Parliament yesterday, Tuesday, Kenya's National Assembly Speaker Justin Muturi cancelled the trip, saying the invitation to the conference was limited to countries with permanent mission at the United Nations headquarters in New York City.
I regret to inform the House that the scheduled travel by the representative of the National Assembly is hereby forthwith cancelled. Those members that were to travel would obviously know how to deal with the other issues related to facilitation, which may have landed in their accounts. You must therefore make good a complete and total refund. The House is accordingly guided.
This comes a day after the United Nations boss advised countries on Monday against sending their delegation to the event for fear of coronavirus. At the same time, Kenya's National Assembly Health Committee member James Nyikal has raised concerns over the Chinese airline that was cleared to land in Kenya despite the ban.
The Spanish flu of 1918 killed nearly 100 million people. One third of the world population at the time killed more people than the First World War. Schools had to be closed. Bodies were being collected from homes. That is the threat we are facing. And I do not see how three cabinet ministers cannot come to attend this.
The committee chairperson, Senator Mbito Malinga, insists that the three cabinet secretaries, Fred Matiang'i of Interior, Mutahi Kagwe of Health, and James Macharia of Transport must appear before the committee today, Wednesday.
We are here to help Kenyans. We want to challenge the DG Immigration. Were you the one who stamped and issued visas for those 239 passengers? Were you the one personally responsible for their entry to this country? I don't think you have an answer for that. If I go to the Minister of the Transport Fears, are you the one who issued personal clearance for that plane to land in this country and said it's okay? Is it you who made that decision personally? We want to find out from the CAS and the acting DG. This issue of self-quarantine, the 239 people, you sent them out to self-quarantine.
Kenya has also moved to suspend flights from North Italy, which usually has direct flights to the coastal region of Kenya, effective yesterday, Tuesday. According to the World Health Organization, the global death toll from the coronavirus epidemic exceeds 3,000, as more than 90,000 cases are reported. So far, the virus has spread to up to 60 countries globally after emerging in China late last year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The United Nations has cancelled hundreds of human rights events because of coronavirus concerns, in accord with the Swiss government's decision to ban all public gatherings of more than 1,000 people. Lisa Schlein reports from the United Nations in Geneva.
In announcing the decision, the president of the UN Human Rights Council, Elisabeth Tichy-Fieselberger, tells delegates she has received an urgent letter from the UN Director General in Geneva spelling out measures that have to be taken in light of the coronavirus situation.
The Director General specified that that would entail cancelling all side events and encouraging representatives to refrain from travelling to Geneva for the rest of the session. She also suggested that those special procedure mandate holders who are not already in Geneva could be encouraged to participate in the session via video conferencing.
Late last week, Swiss authorities took the unprecedented step of prohibiting large public events in response to a growing number of coronavirus cases. As a consequence, events such as the International Motor Show, which attracts a half million people, and Swiss watch exhibits, which draw enthusiastic crowds of thousands of people, have been canceled. Human rights spokesman Rolando Gomez says 200 side events will be canceled until the end of this council session on March 20th. He says that is an unfortunate but responsible measure to take in order to prevent the coronavirus from spreading. He tells VOA the meetings generally attract on average 4,000 to 6,000 participants during the course of the session. He says those side events are very important.
I should point out, just as a technical note, they're not official council side events. They take place in parallel, and they're important as they inform the discussions in the formal proceedings. Of course, those lobbying efforts will continue unabated, which are important.
Side events are organized by non-governmental organizations and states. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights also has spent a lot of time and effort in organizing several gatherings aimed at exploring particular aspects of human rights that demand a more comprehensive hearing and analysis. They will not be held. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, March 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's send a shout-out to listeners on all our VOA affiliate stations around Africa. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Sudan's transitional government has removed laws, rules, and procedures that hamper the ability of humanitarian relief organizations to operate in the country. The move is being welcomed by relief agencies that say humanitarian aid access is needed to restore life to normal in the war-scarred Darfur region. Naba Muhideen has the details from Khartoum.
Sudanese authorities say that all obstacles that ousted government of Omar al-Bashir put in place to obstruct the work of humanitarian organizations and United Nations agencies have been removed. In a statement Friday, the head of Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission, Abbas Fadlullah, said Sudan has opened the door wide for the return of all international humanitarian organizations that were expelled during the era of the former regime. They include organizations like the World Food Programme and the World Health Organization. Under the new rules, international aid agencies no longer have to get permissions from the General Intelligence Service, GIS, and military intelligence to operate in the country. Notifying the Humanitarian Aid Commission is sufficient. Authorities will also halt their inspections of aid agency operations. Ayman al-Badri, director of the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization in Sudan, says he is happy to see the restrictions lifted. He says it's also important and a turning point, especially in observing and following up field work. He says organizations have funds from donors who want to see where the money is spent and who is benefiting it, and that can only be implemented through access to these locations. Previously, many organizations relied on Sudan's government reports or executive agencies, which had a lack of credibility. He says now there is a chance for more credibility. Aid agencies are especially eager to access Darfur, where the Bashir government fought rebel groups for years. At one time, more than 2 million people were displaced from their homes. 23-year-old Mawadda Yagub lives in the Zamzam camp for displaced people. She says the return of aid agencies will make a difference. Mawadda says getting non-governmental organizations back to work in Darfur is so important for internally displaced people like her, especially in the camp she lives in, where previously aid workers were harassed by the former regime and NGOs couldn't work well. Now, if they come back, people will have the humanitarian aid needed. Officials say the decision is part of ongoing peace talks between the transitional government and rebel groups in South Sudan's capital, Juba. The sides are hoping to reach a final peace agreement to stabilize Sudan and allow the country to access international funding for the first time in years. Naba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Sudan's transitional government this week fired more than 100 diplomats who were allegedly appointed without going through proper protocols during the Omar al-Bashir administration. The government says some of the ambassadors do not have the qualifications to be diplomats. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The fired high-ranking diplomats include 14 ambassadors at the Foreign Affairs Ministry appointed by the Ossad President Omar al-Bashir. The government also let go 35 other ambassadors who were appointed to empower the Bashir's administration, according to the Sudan Sovereign Council. Taha Osman, a member of the committee tasked to dismantle the former National Congress Party, says the panel conducted a series of investigations at the Foreign Affairs Ministry and Sudanese embassies abroad and discovered that several diplomats were appointed for being close relatives of top officials in the ministry or for being loyal to the Bashir's administration. Speaking in Arabic, Osman says some diplomats exploited their position for self-gain.
There are immoral acts being done by some diplomats and ambassadors during the previous regime, which does not match with diplomatic ethics and does not represent the dignity of Sudanese people, and it has really destroyed our Sudanese diplomatic history.
Osman says some officials were appointed to their positions with direct instructions from Bashir, which is not proper procedure. Osman says the firings clears the way for appointing qualified diplomats from all different backgrounds who will serve their country honorably.
We wish that this decision would help build a new diplomacy for Sudan based on competency and qualification. And we wish that it would open a new door for transparent employment for all Sudanese, which reflects our diversity.
Khalid Musa, one of the Sudanese ambassadors who lost his job, says the firings are politically motivated.
Every diplomat and every ambassador is heavily invested on their career by the state and by themselves, and it is a human capital for the whole country, especially in this juncture of history, for their experience, for their expertise. And I think this is the right time to use them, not to damage their image.
Musa says the move to fire dozens of diplomats is illegal.
We are Sudanese citizens. All duties and rights are based on citizenship. We think that, you know, this committee doesn't have any right to deprive my citizenship right and to serve my country, and without any evidence.
In early January, the same Sudanese government committee dissolved dozens of institutions, including four media outlets, as part of the campaign to crack down on political activities of members who were appointed during Bashir's 30-year administration. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A Liberian human rights campaigner says he was tortured by the presidential guard when he led hundreds of people to present a petition to President George Weah calling for the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in Liberia. Emmanuel Savis, leader of Liberians United for Justice and Accountability, accused the Executive Protective Service of arresting and torturing him near President Weah's offices. However, late Tuesday, President Weah's office released a statement accusing Savis and his group of breaching security near the president's offices. The statement says Savis and his group broke through the security and blocked vehicle entrances. The police later released all those arrested. Savis spoke with Moses Kaziewu.
You know, we went to petition the President of the Republic of Liberia. We got to the entrance. This is not my first time doing that. We always go, we see protocol, and they tell us what to do. And we told them that we're going to wait right there, and the President is going to come out to all, and we will petition him. They wanted three representatives to go and see the President, and we said, no, we want the President to come to us. And so I took the microphone to tell these guys to go back. By the time I make up my mind, I was off the ground. They took me into the president, to the security booth. They had me on the ground. They put something around my neck, my head, stepped my ears, kicked me in the head. And they made sure to put something around my head. And we did not block the president entrance.
Did you receive major injuries?
Well, right now, as I speak to you, I think you saw me walking. My legs, my knee has been stepped on. I've been beating badly. My two ears, especially my left side, I'm not sure what they're putting around your neck to kick the hell out of you or stepped on you. You know, so I feel a lot of pain here. I want to make sure I'm not bleeding internally. I want to make sure that I'm okay, but I can tell you right now, and in as much as I still have to address this with the police, I'll be suing the government of the Republic of Liberia for what it did to me today.
What kind of petition were you opting to present to the president of Liberia?
We were presenting Warren Economic Crimes Court petition. We want the establishment of Warren Economic Crimes Court. I'm a member of LOJA, actually the executive director and funder. And we went to the national legislature and presented the very same document, and we want to make sure we present it to our president. Unfortunately, our president don't want that document, and so some of us were ordered beating, and that's how I ended up in the hospital.
You were arrested alongside several others, as confirmed by the statement coming from the government through the Office of the Presidential Press Secretary.
I don't understand what it mean by several others. So there were five other people that were arrested. Can you imagine? We had a little under 2,000 people out there, and these people were with us. They all been released. We got to be back at the police station at 10 a.m. tomorrow. They said they are forwarding us to court, and you know, we're waiting to see what happened. We're confident that nothing is going to happen. We did nothing. In fact, we are the one who's supposed to be charging officers that work with the president of the Republic of Liberia. They won't be doing anything to us. We are confident that we have done nothing wrong.
Savvy, why you want this war crimes court established in Liberia?
Simple, 250,000 people died so that there will be no corruption. 250,000 people died so that we can have roles. 250,000 people died so we have medication in the hospital, so JFK can look better. 250,000 people died so we can have a better life. The truth is, 250,000 people died at the hands of those in power so that they can have power, and we have the worst Liberia for them to be able to afford everything they want. We have watched this trend, and, you know, as a man who grew up in this country and son of the soil, you know, I think it's incumbent upon somebody like me and others who think alike to do something about this. And someone may say, this is going to stop me. No, I'm more fired up, and I'm going to still be back here for rallies, and we're still going to make sure that one economic crimes court conversation stay alive.
Emmanuel Savis is the leader of Liberians United for Justice and Accountability. He was speaking with Moses Gaziewu in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed Tuesday the re-election of President Faure Gnassingbé. The court confirmed the Election Commission's results, which gave President Gnassingbé 70% of the total votes and 19% for main opposition candidate Abayomi Kojo. The opposition had rejected the results, saying they were made up. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says now President Gnassingbé can focus on the work of developing the country. Kenyan members of parliament who were set to attend a meeting in New York City have been asked to return their allowances after their trip was canceled due to coronavirus fears. Meanwhile, the National Assembly Health Committee has asked the cabinet secretaries for health, transport, and interior to appear before the committee for questioning about the Chinese airline that was cleared to land in Kenya despite the cancellation of airlines in and out of China. Sudan's transitional government has removed laws, rules, and procedures that hamper the ability of humanitarian relief organizations to operate in the country. The move is being welcomed by relief agencies that say humanitarian aid access is needed to restore life to normal in the war-scarred Darfur region. And a Liberian human rights campaigner says he was tortured by the presidential guard when he led hundreds of people to present a petition to President George Weah calling for the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in Liberia. And that is it for this Wednesday, March 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends? breakout artists? New releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.